Hello, greetings everybody, and wishing you all a lovely morning or evening depending on where you are in the world. Welcome to another episode of the Cricket Slouch, and this is SP, your usual host. For those following global cricket this year, you'd have noticed the number of upsets that we have seen at the T20 World Cup and a few others outside the global tournaments. This led me to think about what some of these victories or upsets would mean for the respective teams and the legacy that it leads to. So I got around talking with Shaunak and Sandeep about this, and we went down nostalgia lane to recall some of the more memorable wins by the unfancied teams in modern cricketing history and the mark that they left on us personally and in cricket in general. And in doing so, we may end up upsetting a few people or reopen old wounds, but that is not our intention. Please have a support person with you if some of these memories cause distress. If not, kick back, relax, and enjoy the chat.
Hey, hello, how are you, Shaunak?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good. Dada, namaskar.
Dhonnobad. Bhalo, Bengali bolle. Bangla.
One of my good friends, he's a Bengali.
Yeah, right.
He's from Kolkata. And we stayed together for a while as well, but you know, for some reason, he never got around to teaching me Bengali.
So, is your mother tongue Marathi, sir?
Yeah, Marathi.
Yeah, okay, so I just guessed that. Oh, I think Sandeep's on as well. Hi, Sandeep.
Hello, can you hear me?
Oh, yes.
No, good.
All right, well, let's start.
Yeah, sure.
So, welcome, Sandeep, and welcome, Shaunak. Looks like Shaunak enjoyed his time with me last time so much that he agreed to come back again.
I did, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be back.
My honor. And Sandeep, how's things?
Yeah, not too bad. I'm doing all right, yeah.
Yeah, you have been missing in action for a while. So, it's yeah. Nice to have you back and, you know, doing something that we do best, which is going down nostalgia lane and digging up some old gems to talk and discuss. And I think it's another aspect of cricket fandom in a way, isn't it? That not just focusing on what's going on now in the cricket world, and trust me, there's a lot to talk about in the cricket world right now. But sometimes, you know, just going, rewinding that time and talking about games that, you know, either meant so much back then or games that we still remember fondly.
Yeah, so I reckon like nostalgia plays a heavy role in pretty much all sports, but in cricket especially, like, you know, having grown up with it, cricket nostalgia is something that I cherish and I absolutely love.
Yeah, I agree. And I was just listening to the 81 All podcast the other day about you know, greatness in sport and what we call greatness. And there is a huge element of nostalgia associated with that. And one particular example they're talking about was Kimar Roach's stats compared with Andy Roberts. Now, numbers-wise, they are very, very similar, possibly even better. But then you don't associate Kimar Roach with that same level of greatness that we talk about when, you know, we talk about Andy Roberts.
Yeah, part of what like made Andy Roberts even more special is that he was surrounded by even more amazing bowlers. Unfortunately, and like, see, I myself find it annoying that when commentators keep on comparing the current generation to the golden generation of West Indies cricket, because I reckon like it's hard for countries to maintain that level of standard, because when you think about it, like West Indies combined, they only have a population of 7 million. So it's quite amazing what they achieved back in the 70s and 80s with the fanatical following and, yeah, an astounding quality of players. And West Indies, unfortunately, like, don't have that, like nowhere near that. So so even if you have, like, you know, some good players coming through, it's not enough to elevate the entire team's performance, which is, yeah, still it's pretty poor, like, I think in all three formats. Even in T20 World Cup, yeah, we saw what happened. So, but, yeah, it's just sad, yeah, what's happened. But, yeah, I don't want to dwell on it.
No, I think if we were to talk about that, we'd probably need a couple of days, maybe weeks, to discuss these issues. Okay, so back to our topic. So sure. We thought we'll discuss, like, given this year, how many results we've had where, you know, far less fancy teams have beat, you know, their so-called, in inverted commas, better teams. I thought it would be nice to talk about some of these upsets from the past and just to see what it meant at that time within the broader context of the game, but also perhaps to the team as an entity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this particular year started with a similar upset of sorts with Bangladesh beating New Zealand in the test match mm-hmm. in New Zealand. And I think mm-hmm. Sandeep might want to talk about that a bit later. I have a suspicion that that's one of his, right? Okay, so we'll get to that. Okay.
Yeah. Don't hold back, Sandeep. Let it out.
Yeah, because and I think in test matches you don't often get these sort of upsets because the nature of the game is such that you have more time and you can easily come back from behind if you're suddenly on the back foot, and the better teams usually always come out on top, so either they might draw the game or win. But the shorter formats don't often always give us that luxury, and that's where we get most of these upsets. And the other reason we see a lot of these upsets in the World Cup tournaments is because those are the only multi-nation tournaments some of the lower-ranked teams get to participate in and brush shoulders with the big boys.
Yeah, which is a sad indictment of cricket. I think Test cricket could definitely be more competitive. Your statements are completely valid that it's a completely different game. And it's such a long game that teams have opportunity to come back. So generally over, say, 4 to 5 days, the better team will always prevail or most likely prevail. But because of the condensed nature of one-day cricket and T20 formats, and also there's the simple fact that all the ICC members play T20 cricket, which is not the case with Test cricket, and also even with one-day cricket. And not all the teams have status as well.
Mm.
So even all that contributes to the lack of upsets.
Yeah. And again, if you look at the Football World Cup as well, we don't often see bilaterals between Saudi and Argentina or Japan and Germany. These are the only tournaments they get to play each other,
mm-hmm.
isn't it? So, yeah. But then football is much more widely played sport, and I think they have to have a certain pathway to get to the World Cups. And I think that's something that FIFA does, I won't say well, but at least there is consistency and transparency in the pathway. And, it has been there for years, unlike the ICC, which just short shrifts and changes things, within the space of a few months. And then suddenly nobody knows what they need to do to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other advantage that FIFA has is because it's a sport that's so widely popular around the globe, and all the nations that are members of FIFA, they play it. So even if Saudi Arabia doesn't play games against Argentina or Brazil or the top European nations, they get good competition from teams that are at a similar level in their own region in Asia. So Australia, Saudi Arabia, it is a pretty competitive game. And that happens pretty often.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Yeah, and they got a proper qualifier as well. I mean, all the nations have to go through the qualifier to come to the World Cup. Just because Brazil has won last time, they don't get automatic qualification this time, isn't it? So they have to play the qualifier. Whereas that's not the case. A lot of our nations get direct entry to World Cup. So.
Well, the USA has got direct entry for next year's... not next year, the 2024...
Yeah, they're hosts, isn't it? They're hosts, so...
Yes.
That makes sense.
Although, interestingly, the World Cup that is being held partly by Namibia in 2027, the ODI World Cup, Namibia doesn't get automatic entry into the World Cup. They still have to qualify.
That is surprising, isn't it? So that's basically double standards. I don't know of what proportion, but...
It tells you, it lays down ICC's motivations quite clearly. USA is a population of 350 million. Big market for cricket. There is potential to grow the game there. Whereas Namibia, it's unbelievable what they have achieved. But they only have a population of 2.8 million, I think. So it's a tiny nation. And in the end, money talks, unfortunately. So, but I think if I was Namibia, if I was in the heading of the cricketing organ, I would be pretty angry about that I don't get to qualify automatically in a tournament which I'm hosting. which pretty much happens in most other sports, I would imagine.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's what Sandeep said. Like, most other sports, you don't automatically qualify. You still have to go through qualification process. I mean, look at not just host nation, but even previous winners. Italy got knocked out. They didn't even reach the main draw.
Mm. And you see, different to cricket, you don't have football fans saying, oh, this World Cup is terrible without Italy. How come they are not there? Like, we shouldn't give status to these lower nations. They should be kicked out. We just don't have that, you know. And it's, I think the fan base in cricket also, I think it's getting a lot better. So on the positive note, I have noticed a shift in attitudes over time, and especially in the last 3 years, after like ICC gave universal status to all the T20 nations, and you see their achievements getting reflected in the scorecards and in stats. I think that's changing attitudes. So it's a good thing for cricket.
Absolutely. I think it's just that colonial and aristocratic hangover that the sport has sort of been through and lived with, and the amount of control certain cricketing populations have had on everything else. I mean, if it wasn't for India's population and the huge market that it brings to the sport, and therefore the money, I don't think India would have enjoyed as much power as it has done recently in the last 10, 15 years or so.
Yeah, correct.
All right, so let's get cracking. Now, there have been quite a few upsets. I'll let you guys start. Sandeep, why don't we start with you? Like, you've been watching cricket even before I started. I think I started early 90s. You've been watching a few games before that too. Yeah. I've only got, not memories, but my knowledge of some of those games is basically based on what I've read about them. And if ever somebody was kind enough to put up like a few clips online or as part of a documentary.
Yeah.
In your recollection, which was the earliest so-called cricketing upset that you came across, or which people talked about as, oh my God, this was a completely unexpected result?
I'm looking at test matches. I mean, because as we said earlier, it's very rare to get a test match upset because of, the top quality teams do end up winning against less fancy teams because it's over such a long period of time. If you look back, there are very few upsets. There are not many. There may be the occasional test match that some less fancy team might have won, but the overall, if you consider the series, they tend to lose anyway. The earliest upset probably was in 1971 when India beat England in that series 1-0, but that was helped by the fact that the two of the matches were the weather elements had a big role to play in two of the test matches, and the last test match was on the Oval where our spinners had a feel. Our spinners found the pitch very helpful. So that could be explained away. When you're talking of an upset, it should be like there is no explanation how it happened, really, isn't it? It just does not make sense.
Where, nobody gave that team a chance to win. So, like when Shaunak mentioned West Indies earlier, think about a team like Sri Lanka or Ireland beating West Indies in the 70s and 80s versus Ireland beating West Indies this year.
Yeah, absolutely. So I looked at that there was this Zimbabwe winning their first test in 1995. This was against Pakistan at Harare. And the manner they won the match was absolutely amazing. They thrashed Pakistan by an innings and 80 runs or something like that. And that was a big surprise because it was Pakistan with Wasim Akram and all those people. But Zimbabwe had their own match winners. They had the Flower Brothers who made big scores in that match. And they had Heath Streak, who was a great bowler as well. So while it was a surprise, they won the match, but they lost the series 2-1. So in the end, it all worked out better for Pakistan. So So it was a surprise, but you can explain it away that the Zimbabwe was a decent, good team, and it was at home, and they caught Pakistan unawares in that match. Australia lost to Bangladesh in 2017 at home again. This was the first time Bangladesh beat Australia in a test match, but it was a spinning track. Shakib Al Hasan played a great role with both ball and bat, and Australia are quite vulnerable to spin anyway. So, again, you can explain it away that way.
I suppose again, just to clarify, sorry about that, but when you say lost to Bangladesh at home, you mean lost to Bangladesh in Bangladesh?
In Bangladesh, it was in Bangladesh at Dhaka on the spinning track. So, you can explain that one as well. I also consider India beating Australia recently at the Gabba. Injury hit India beating full strength Australia to win the series 2-1. But I mean, you can't really call India beating Australia an upset, really, can you, at this day and age when India has got enough quality batsmen and good bench strength as well? So I ruled that one out as well. Bangladesh beating New Zealand, that was big, wasn't it, really?
It was huge. I think it just started off this year on a much different note, wasn't it? It's like the first test match of the year of sorts.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that came out of nowhere, to be honest. Bangladesh, not great travelers at all. And not even great at home, to be honest. And them beating New Zealand. New Zealand are unbeatable at home, virtually. So where did that come from? But I mean, New Zealand won the second test, and parity was restored again. So over the series, Bangladesh did not create any. It was not a big upset for the series, but it was an upset for that particular match, definitely, no doubt about it. Okay.
Yeah, and the guy that ended up grabbing a bagload of wickets, Ibadut, I think he had a really poor test record before the game. So it was a shocking that he ended up being the one, the match winner, and taking so many wickets. So quite an unexpected result.
Yeah, but before that test match, Mohammad Issam, who contributes for Cricket Info, he did mention something about Ibadut, and he said that, look, watch out for this young guy. I mean, he might be erratic and not highly reliable, but, you know, he is quite capable of making a difference. And then the test match unfolded as it did, and it turns out, you know, it just proved him right. But since you're on that theme of New Zealand as well, I think one other test match you might want to add to your list is Sri Lanka beating New Zealand in New Zealand in 95.
That's right, yeah. But again, Sri Lanka had a pretty good team then, isn't it? I mean,
that was Sri Lanka's first away win, and Sri Lanka were yet to win the World Cup. They were yet to be seen as a really strong, competitive team, especially away from home.
Absolutely, but they had a good group of great players who went on to become great at the time. So then there is the Pakistan losing to Zimbabwe again in 2013. I mean, this was Zimbabwe, which had been stripped of the test status for a few years, and they'd just come back. And how did that even happen? I mean, it was a very narrow victory for Zimbabwe by 24 runs. Zimbabwe, I mean, if you go through the scorecard, they didn't have any players that you would probably recall now. But I mean, the overall series ended in a 1-1 draw. So that was a big surprise. But the biggest of all, in my opinion, I think it's Sri Lanka beating South Africa 2-0 in South Africa. That happened in 2019.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I think Kusal Mendes? Kusal Pereira.
And I think Karuna Ratne also played a part in that.
He did. So, I mean, it absolutely makes no sense whatsoever, this particular series, because South Africa have never lost to anybody apart from Australia and England in the home test series. Even the Asian giants, India and Pakistan, have never managed to win a test series in South Africa in all the years that I've played. So how, I mean, going into this series, Sri Lanka had lost to Australia, were thrashed by Australia, had been thrashed by New Zealand. They had lost to England 3-0 at home. In Sri Lanka, they had lost 3-0 to England. South Africa, on the other hand, they had won 7 of their last test series at home. And I mean, there, South Africa were virtually unbeatable at home. They had just beaten Pakistan 3-0 just before Sri Lanka arrived. Sri Lanka, as usual, they had been playing musical chairs with their captaincy. So it was Chandimal who had been captain for Australia and New Zealand, and he was unceremoniously dropped after that. Angelo Matthews was in bad books as well at this time. So it was Dimuth Karunaratne who was made the latest captain. And it was just a team that didn't have any great stars, really. And they beat South Africa. So the first test was they were chasing 304 in the fourth innings, 226 for 9. And from there, Pereira plays this magnificent innings where they go on to win. I mean, a lot of people say that Ben Stokes' knock at Headingley is the best test innings ever, isn't it? But I don't think it was even the best test innings of that year. I think that was done by Pereira in that match.
I agree. I think Ben Stokes' innings was also laced with a lot of mishits and drops, and that run out attempt that.
Yeah.
No, I think it was an LB or something.
That got him out. But yeah. Pereira's on the other hand. Yeah, you're right. It was completely chanceless innings.
Yeah.
And yeah, see, another thing, England's victory came at home, whereas Sri Lanka's came away, as you mentioned, Sandeep.
So,
I agree with you completely that should hold the mantle for the best test innings, at least I'll see.
Yeah. So the go on to win that, I mean, that was absolutely amazing knock from Pereira in the end, with Vishwa Fernando as his company. So that was the first test. And then you would expect South Africa to come back in the game. Sri Lanka dismissed for 154 in the first knock, conceding a lead of South Africa's. And then they come back and bowl South Africa out for 128. They had Vishwa Fernando, Rajita, and Suranga Lakmal as their bowlers who took the wickets. And then they needed 195 in the fourth innings. Again, you would favor South Africa on a fourth innings pitch where there have been very low scores. And Sri Lanka 34 for 2. And from there, they don't lose a wicket. Oshara Fernando and Kushala Mendes, they go on to get the 195. They add 160 between them and get the 195. I mean, that's absolutely amazing. I mean, I don't think it will ever happen again. It's something that I can't explain how it happened, really, because South Africa is so strong team at home. To do that twice, not once, but twice in the same series is beyond belief.
That second match to come back with that first innings deficit and then have this massive partnership in the fourth innings to win that test match, I mean, it's just absolute bonkers. And like you say, you know, the mismatch or the disparity in the two sides was just phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from then on, I don't think Sri Lanka capitalized. I thought this would be a coming back of Sri Lanka, but they haven't really lived up to that standards again. I mean, at least they've kept Dimuth Karunaratne as the captain, so that's not changed since then. But their results since then have been pretty much mixed, I must say. So
I think it's like Sri Lanka is going through this massive transition. They do have a lot of good, decent young talent, because the other day I was watching the Lankan Premier League on TV at one of the restaurants I was at. And you know, to be fair, a lot of the players in that team, this was just one particular match, were Sri Lankan, and you had a couple of Afghani or Pakistani players. Yeah. But some of the talent over there was fantastic. There's this spinner called Velalage. I can't remember his first name. Velalage, but he looked really good. Now, again, you know, you have to take it with a pinch of salt because, you know, local homegrown conditions don't know how he'll do well. Yeah. But from what I saw of that other chap as well, the one who played in the test matches against Australia, was it Prabhat Jayasurya?
Yeah.
So, you know, they do have quite a few good spinners in there. Yeah. And it's just a matter of getting two, maybe three batters in who can actually bat for time and, you know, understands the nuances of first class. So I think they will get there. But, you know, given the current socio-political situation within their country, they've got a lot of other things, you know, pressing matters to think about than the state of their cricket team. But despite that, you know, they won the Asia Cup recently. They didn't have a really good outing in the World Cup, which, again, I was a little bit disappointed by. But, you know, one can hope that things get better.
Yeah. Yeah, so I thought this was the biggest upset of a test series, to be honest. Because, I mean, South Africa had decent batting as well, not like now when their batting cannot conjure up to a score of 200. I think they still had Hashim Amla and Faf to play. I mean, Hashim Amla probably on the decline by then, but still he is much better than the current lot of batsmen, I would say.
Adeen Elgar, and they had Aidan Markram. And Markram in his early few years was like a really good, consistent batsman.
He was, yeah.
And not to mention they had Quinton de Kock as well.
Oh, yeah. So, I was just going to mention that. De Kock.
Faf du Plessis was there as well. So.
Yeah. I think Faf was the captain, if I'm not mistaken.
He was, yeah.
He was, yeah.
Yeah. And then there's the bowling. So you had, I think Steyn was still playing. Rabada was definitely there.
Rabada, yeah. Maharaj.
Yeah.
NGD,
yeah.
Wow, that's good. Yeah, that's actually a proper upset, you know, because, you know, you generally remember Kushal Pereira's inning and that test match that Sri Lanka won, but you don't often think of the second test match, which again they won.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Somehow it just falls under the radar, isn't it? And again, it's all about what we choose to remember and what we don't. So, yeah, that's what makes the difference between a great innings or a great win and something like it's just a run-of-the-mill stuff.
Yeah. I think more than a win, if that win is achieved by a single player playing a spectacular out-of-the-world innings, like that sticks in the memory a lot more than, say, just a standard win. But yeah, also depends on the context. Like, for example, like, you know, as a fan of associate cricket, when associate teams meet full members, I would remember that, even though like there are no outstanding individual performances involved that are all that memorable.
Yeah. So what's your next upset, Shaunak? Which one will you go for?
Yeah, so in keeping with the associate theme, so see, this is a game that I actually haven't watched. It was played before I was born, and it's not that well known. But so let me interest you guys. Okay, so this happened in 1964. It was a game between Netherlands and Australia. So what happened was Australia was just coming off an Ashes win. I think they had traveled to England for, if memory serves me correct, a 5-match test series or a 3-match test series, and they had won 1-0. And before going back, I think Netherlands had somehow persuaded them to come over for a one-off one-day game. And back then, you know, the one-day games were 60 overs long. Yeah, so what happened was, unbelievably, the Netherlands achieved their first victory against a test nation. And they did so by beating Australia by 3 wickets. So, and the game was at The Hague, and as I mentioned before, in 1964. And if people remember, so Bill Laurie was the captain of the Australian team then. So it was a proper good team, you know. And back then also, like cricket in Netherlands was a lot more popular than it is today. And the reasons for this are interesting, because back then cricket was available free to air on BBC. And if you lived in Netherlands near the coast, you could actually get like BBC coverage because a lot of the satellite would pick it up. And that's how, interestingly, like people became involved with cricket in Netherlands. And so this crazy game, it was, so let me just describe to you like what happened in the game itself. It was played in front of a sellout crowd of 15,000 people. So Australia batted first, then on a tacky pitch, they got bowled out for 197. And then against all expectations, the Dutch then chased this down in the 50th over for the loss of 7 wickets. And this game was very significant for Dutch cricket because it helped elevate their profile and they actually became associate members 2 years later. So very consequential game. And what's sad though, like since that upset happened all the way back in 1964, the Dutch have only played a total of 4 times against Australia in 58 years, if you can believe it. And all those 4 have been ODIs in, I think that they played 2 games in 1989. Similarly, after Australia were returning home from an Ashes and they just stopped in Netherlands on the way and played a couple of ODIs. And then after that, in 2003 World Cup and 2007 ODI World Cup. Apart from that, the Netherlands and Australia have never played each other and not in a single T20I as well. And yeah, just to sum up, if anyone is interested in watching the highlights of the game, how I came across it was like there's a video on YouTube with Dutch commentary and English subtitles. It's a video by 13th Man. So if you go on his channel, you can look this up. But it's an amazing result that's not that well known in the wider cricketing world.
Excellent. That is a great find. And mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken, when Jared Kimber did his Double Century podcast mm-hmm. list and talked about some of these teams, he may have mentioned that. I'll make it a point that I'll get the link to this guy's video and put it up in the show notes for anyone who wants to check it up later on. So what was the guy's again? The 13th man?
The 13th man. Yeah, I'll happily send over the link to you.
Perfect. Yeah, text it to me.
Yeah, we'll definitely will do.
No, that's amazing. So basically the motto for Dutch cricket should be embarrassing full member country since 1964.
Very well said.
Yeah, because if you look at it, that they beat a decent strength Australia side, and even though they may not have met Australia as much, you know, as probably they would have liked to, they did beat England twice in T20 internationals, and I think to this day remain the only team that England have never beat in a T20 international.
Which is an amazing stat, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was my contribution. I've got more, but I think we can do like one each. That way we will keep the conversation.
Absolutely. And I think the point that you mentioned about the about them getting associate status after that, you know, is equally important because some of these matches that we will talk about or we have spoken about, you know, would have that lasting legacy of sorts, I would say.
Yeah.
And for me, to that effect, would be the first game that I would like to talk about is Kenya beating West Indies in the 96 World Cup.
Oh, yes.
Partly because I actually watched that match on TV in the middle of my 12th standard exams.
Nice.
Yeah, and my mother is going in the background, why are you watching cricket? Don't you have an exam going on? And I just said, well, the exam comes twice a year. The World Cup comes once every 4 years.
So, hey, my question for you, did you watch this in the UAE or in India?
No, I was in India at that time.
Okay, cool.
It was February, just smack bang in the middle of the board exams, and that game was there. And I was in Pune at that time. This match was in Pune as well. I wanted to go to the stadium, but I didn't know anyone who had tickets, so I had to basically watch it from home on TV.
Brilliant, good story. So go on, describe it.
Yeah, so my earliest recollection of an upset is basically Zimbabwe beating England in the 92 World Cup. But that was in Australia. It was held in the cricketing backwaters of Albury, Wodonga. Well, it's a twin town, Albury and Wodonga. And it's a very, very small town. I think they thought, look, it's Zimbabwe. They're not going to win anything. They'll chuck that game over there. But as things turned out, Zimbabwe beat England, one of their many upsets over full member countries as well. But I didn't get to watch that game. I only read about it in the newspapers after the match was over. And I thought, wow, this is huge. And considering that England then went on to reach the final, I think it just put that into a greater context. But this one, I actually watched live. And You know, when you talk about a nation of ragtag cricketers, that was what Kenya was. You know, people sort of pulled across, pulled in from different walks of life. You know, the dentist in Deepak Chudasama, the shopkeeper in, what's that keeper's name? Asif Iqbal. Then you had an insurance salesman in Asif Kareem, who was also a former tennis player. And then, you know, you had people like Hitesh Modi, who was, again, relatively fairly influential in other spheres of Kenyan life. Then you had Odombe, you had Tikolo. Like, everybody just banded in together. And, you know, you could see that there was this spirit about them, that they just were there to enjoy their cricket. I don't think they even expected to beat anyone that year. And then you had UAE and Netherlands in the same World Cup, and they got smashed by almost everybody. So comparatively, Kenya was playing better. And there was a part in me that thought, you know, I just wish these guys beat one team, just one team. And Pune gave them that opportunity. And I still remember watching this catch where Asif Iqbal, so Brian Lara edges this ball, and then Asif Iqbal gets this catch, which kind of doesn't sit in his hands like, you know, wicketkeepers would take. You know, when you play gully cricket in India, you always have this guy who's keeping because he doesn't want to field, or you kind of think he's not reliable in the outfield and just put him there behind the stumps, hoping that he'll stop a ball. And then somehow he just catches one in between his thighs. And that was what this catch was like. And I thought, oh my God, this is huge. Like, this is Brian Lara's wicket. And then slowly but surely, you know, that trap kind of closed in on West Indies. They just kept losing wickets. And it was wonderful to see them, like, dance with joy on the ground, take that lap of honor. And let's face it, because of the universities in Pune, there were a few African students who live in Pune, and some of them were Kenyan, and these guys had gone to watch the match. I just thought, how proud would they be of their team?
Yeah, I watched this match as well on TV. And I mean, this was a good West Indies side, actually. It was not...
yeah, it was a good side because, like you said, you know, it was basically a full strength West Indies. You had Ambrose, Walsh, Bishop, Campbell, Lara, Richie Richardson, Jimmy Adams, Arthurton, Roger Harper.
So, yeah, it was a big, big upset at that time. And I did watch all the things that you mentioned, Brian Lara's catch, the joy with which Kenyan celebrated at the end. So, yeah, it was great, great result for Kenya at that time. Yeah,
huge result. And I think the repercussions were to be seen later on down the line, because even though they didn't win much in 1999, you know, they still had a better degree of success in 2003 when they managed to beat Sri Lanka. And they came close to beating Australia as well in that tournament. And they reached the semifinals. So it was really good. They actually also beat Zimbabwe in 2003. And then, you know, they produced... Yeah, they beat Bangladesh as well. And they produced a lot of good quality players. And then all of a sudden, they just disappeared.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I have some insight as to why that happened. I think the main problem with Kenya was the game was never popular at a spectator level. So it was popular with the Indian expat population that resided in Kenya, but that was a minority, and some small portion of the local African population. But I think besides that, the game wasn't accessible. It was only accessible to the rich upper class, and also the clubs from which these players came. I think these were founded by Indian businessmen. And yeah, I think there was some community tensions as well between the Kenyans, the black Kenyans, and the Indian Kenyans. And all that, and I think the organization there like made a lot of mistakes because of all the amazing results. You know, they primarily focused on developing the national team, like getting them contracts. And what happened was as soon as the golden generation faded away, because of the lack of investment in domestic cricket, you know, the cricket scene completely fell apart. And yeah, it's quite sad like where they are now. They're still playing. So if you look at the Challenge League, which is the third division of one-day cricket currently, they're playing in that. And they are basically a shadow of their former self. And yeah, I think I mentioned this on the last podcast as well with you, Sagar. But yeah, Africa is a growth region for cricket. But I see other nations such as Rwanda, Uganda, like comfortably getting, like, you know, overtaking them in the future.
Yeah, I think so. I think Uganda has beaten Kenya recently in a couple of bilaterals and multi-nation tournaments too. And like you say, you know, it is a fall from grace for them having to play in the third division, so to speak.
Yeah, and even in T20s, they're quite poor. So they did qualify. So recently, there was the 2024 African Regional Qualifiers going on. Quite an interesting tournament, lots of interesting results. But ultimately, there was two sub-regionals. And finally, Rwanda, Tanzania, Nigeria, and Kenya. So these four teams made to the regional final, where they will play against Uganda, Zimbabwe, and Namibia.
Yeah. And
in that tournament, the final two places, the team that secures secured the top two spots, they will qualify for the 2024 World Cup. So I think it's going to be Zimbabwe and Namibia. But yeah, hopefully we see some upsets. And yeah, there's a lot of interesting results in the regional.
I know. And there's some great rivalries forming up already over there, isn't it?
Yeah, especially in the Eastern Africa region. So you have the whole Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, all neighboring nations. And yeah, so it's good stuff. And hopefully cricket continues to develop over there.
It just goes to show what bureaucratic apathy can do to the development of sport. Not just development, but the growth of sport as well. Mm-hmm. So I hope that they get their act right. And eventually, you know, Kenya sort of reemerges from its so-called ashes and becomes a competitive team, not just within the region, but even at global events at some stage. But yeah, I mean, for me, those memories were just too special watching them win.
I don't know if you recall, I mean, Kenya also beat India a couple of times in a tri-series.
Yes, they did.
Yes. Steve Ticolo, he was the star player in both games from memory.
Yeah, you know, this is my personally held belief that Steve Ticolo is probably the finest batsman never to have played tests.
Yeah.
And I agree with you in that assessment completely. He was
just my own belief, because he was technically very good. He knew how to pace his innings. He didn't get out to any massively flashy shots or anything like that. He always had this reliable 30s, 40s, you know, the occasional 50s as well. And he just looked so elegant when playing.
Mm-hmm. And another name that I'll throw in the ring, which is a modern name, but Gerhard Erasmus of Namibia.
Yes.
He's so classy. Definitely, in my opinion, the classiest batter in associate cricket currently. And he played a lot of good innings in the Intercontinental Cup competition that we used to have just a couple of years before. And yeah, it's a pity, but like, it's good at least that Namibia, I reckon there'll be a constant presence at Cricket World Cups now with the T20 World Cup going to 20 nations and then one day.
I expect them to be, because, you know, not this World Cup, the last World Cup, David Visa was an absolute superstar. But I think this World Cup showed that they have other good, reliable players as well. And Dan Besic, he often talks a lot about Erasmus.
That's correct. He's a big fan.
Yeah. All right. So moving on. Sandeep, what you got next on the table?
Well, I had this Kenya's as well, myself. I mean, the not just the Kenya win against West Indies, but actually their run in the 2003 World Cup semifinals, because they are the only team really who have made it to the semifinal stage, isn't it? The associate team in an ODI World Cup, and I don't think that will ever happen. I don't expect that to happen again in the near future. So that's been... And they beat test-playing nations at the time. They beat Sri Lanka, they beat Bangladesh, they beat Zimbabwe. And, I mean, the Australia match was also pretty close, wasn't it? I mean, Asif Karim coming up with those three wickets to sort of ruffle the feathers of the Australians.
Oh, yeah. Australia were pretty much staring at possible defeat. And, you know, it took, Andrew Simons and was it Ian Harvey or someone?
Yeah.
It took a really uncharacteristic sedate innings from them to ensure that they didn't lose any more wickets.
Yeah. And, of course, they got a walkover from New Zealand, but that's not their fault, really, is that? I mean, I think you can win one match in that tournament as an upset. But, I mean, this was a pretty consistent performance from Kenya throughout the tournament, and that's something that we have not seen from a less fancy team either before that. Well, we have seen it before that in 1983, but
no one expected India to win the World Cup, that's for sure.
That was my final one, actually, but I will talk about that later.
But going back to Asif Kareem, I just wanted to mention his figures in that game, which are incredible for any form of cricket. 8.2 overs, 6 maidens, 7 runs, 3 wickets.
Yeah,
I think only Scotty.
Yeah, they were of Ricky Ponting, Darren Lehman, and Brad Hogg. Yeah. So, what an amazing spell.
I think probably bested only by Scotty Boland in recent years. except Scotty Boland just plays test. But man, what a find for Australia, Scotty Boland.
He's got indigenous heritage as well, which is a good thing for Australian cricket.
Absolutely. Well, not just cricket in general, but, you know, opportunities for underprivileged people.
Yes.
Okay, Sandeep, do you have a backup then? Or shall we move on to the next one?
Shaunak?
Yes, so I'll stick with the associate theme then. And the one that I wanted to mention was 2011. And I'm pretty sure both of you will remember this quite fondly. It is Ireland beating England in the 2011 ODI World Cup.
And you're stealing my thunder now.
I swear I didn't know. But yeah, so I'll say my piece and then you can add yours. I think we can do a combined one. I think that'll
Sure, no worries.
So what I'll just say is shortly that, Kevin O'Brien's scintillating 100, coming back, Ireland coming back from being 111 for 5 to chase down a big score of 329 for 7. And yeah, it's quite incredible that now in the era of T20 cricket, big bats, flat pitches, and bowlers getting flogged all over. Like O'Brien's century of 50 balls, it still remains the fastest World Cup 100 of all time, which is incredible. And I think that this victory, alongside the one that they achieved 4 years earlier against Pakistan in 2007, it really set the game in motion there and put Ireland on the pathway to full membership. So it's very highly significant in that way. And I have done some research and read articles which said that the participation numbers in Ireland before these two World Cups were pretty low. It used to hang around, say, 10,000 to 14,000, so quite low, even for a nation of, I think, 4.6 million or so. But yeah, it practically doubled overnight after they achieved success. And, you know, in Ireland, where cricket struggles for media attention and it's a minority sport, every time the team beats England, it makes the front page of newspapers there.
But so, I think every time anyone beats England, it makes the front page of any major newspaper. You know, there's no love. And there's no love lost between most countries and England, you know, whether it is football or cricket or something else.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, what was special about this game was I had actually lived and worked in Ireland for a brief period of time before that happened.
Wow. Awesome.
So I still had, you know, a lot of memories associated with my time over there. And the Irish people are just such a bunch of beautiful, beautiful people. I think it was just the context of the match, isn't it? Where like England had smashed 327, 328 something. And Ireland then were about 110, 111 for 5, pretty much at the midway mark. And I was at work that day. Incidentally, I was working in Sheffield. And I only could check the scores via Crick Info. So I was just checking it I mean, when you see England scoring 325, you kind of think, well, this is a foregone conclusion. And, you know, you kind of sort of give it up. But I thought, look, at least there may be some chance. I mean, if Ireland had batted first and scored 270, and then if England was three or four early wickets down, then they had a better chance, like they did against Pakistan in that game in West Indies. But batting second, you kind of thought, well, do they have it in them to catch up? Because the asking run rate was just pretty steep. But then the game was at Bangalore, sort of shorter grounds. Kevin O'Brien had played an important role in Ireland's victories in the Intercontinental Cup before as well. And they were, you know, hot on the streak of, I think, winning their third Intercontinental Cup or something like that. So there was still hope. There was still hope. At least I hoped that they would put up a fight. And then as time progressed, you know, the updates came through. Okay, still 5 wickets down. And now they've scored 10 runs in an over. They've scored 8 runs in an over. So they were basically ticking along pretty nicely. And then I was on my way home during the last, I think it was the last 5 overs. So, and as Sandeep knows, you know, the drive from Sheffield to Manchester is not an easy ride because there's no straight road. You know, you have to go through these, you know, the series of winding sections. Snake Pass. Or even Woodhead. If you go through Woodhead is the same. And I was just not speeding, but I just wanted to make it home on time towards the end of this game. I knew I couldn't, but I did try my best. And as the radio commentary kicked in, because, you know, there are patches where you lose connectivity in that area.
Yeah.
You know, I was just getting so excited, thinking, oh, my God, like, is the unthinkable going to happen now? You know, will Ireland cross through? And, yeah, it happened. Ireland won. And I don't remember who it was on the radio, but I just went ballistic in this car. Of course, mindful of other people and all of that. But there was just something nice about that feeling that welled up inside me, thinking, you know, this is proper David versus Goliath stuff. And to come back from being 110 for 5 at that 25-over mark and then scoring another 220-odd runs in the remaining 25 was just phenomenal. And then there's this film. I don't know if you've heard this film, The Replacements. It's a Keanu Reeves film.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing special, but it's just this generally feel-good film. The premise is this American football team, and the, you know, superstars have gone on strike because they want money. The owner says, screw you, we'll get in a bunch of replacement players. So Gene Hackman is the replacement coach, and he collects this ragtag bunch of people from different walks of life to just fill in temporarily for those 4 games. And then they win their last game to make it to the playoffs. And at the end of the film, Gene Hackman says this line that, you know, these guys were just replacement players. There was no ticker tape parade for them. There were no medals, no sneaker deals, no endorsements of any kind. But because of what they had achieved, they had touched greatness. And greatness, no matter how brief, always lives with a man. And, you know, that line, and then David Bowie's soundtrack, The Heroes, kicks in. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like that. After this Irish win, thinking this is true. Like, if Ireland win nothing else for the rest of their cricketing career, or even if they disappear entirely from the cricketing calendar, they still have got something to be proud of what they did, the stage at which they did it, and the manner in which they achieved it.
Absolutely. Yeah, an incredible line. I hadn't heard about the movie you mentioned, but that line you said, yeah, it's very appropriate for this game.
It's not a big spectacular film, but I think it's just a feel good sports film. So if you haven't watched it, watch it. It should be there on Netflix,
yeah,
or it'll be there someplace.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of upset, this was much bigger than their win over Pakistan in 2007. I would imagine because.
Oh yeah, and I think any wins over Pakistan should be disqualified as being an upset because you just never know what Pakistan turns up.
Pakistan is a crazy pendulum swinging team. Like, you know, yeah, they could reach the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's unfortunate. Look, I admire what Pakistan have done, and I was a big follower of the Pakistani team in the mid-90s, mostly because of Wasim and Waqar, and then later Yusuf Yohana and, you know, a few other guys. But Pakistan as a team is just so unreliable, probably next only to the West Indies.
Yeah.
Well, the current West Indies.
Current, yeah.
But I think what made the 2011 win more significant, because in 2007, it was, I think the win by Ireland was simply dismissed as a fluke. And ultimately, you guys all remember what happened. Like India and Pakistan both got eliminated in the group stage.
Yeah.
And Ireland and Bangladesh made, and then everyone was complaining, oh, that, you know, there are two uncompetitive teams. It's dragging on too long. And the tournament from memory was also had other problems with regards to like low crowds, very high prices for tickets. So I think it was just a bad vibe with that tournament. So, but yeah, in 2011, I think all I remember is this win got a lot more publicity. It wasn't tainted by anything negative, and it was just amazing and special.
Because that 2007 one, as you say, you know, even though there were a few other issues with the tournament that were justified, one thing they got right was the format. Four groups, four teams each, you got to win those matches. So every game, no matter who it was against, was highly contextual, and you just had to put in your best. It is sad that the ICC have abandoned that and just shrunk the pool for the teams.
And, you know, I reckon in hindsight with what happened in the tournament, we are never going back to that format, because the broadcasters themselves, they demand that, oh, India has to play a certain amount of games minimum in the tournament, because those games drive high viewership just because of India's population. It's sad, but ultimately, I think if cricket gains a foothold in other highly populated countries, I think this would help. But I'm just glad, like, at least with the T20 World Cup, the format for 2024 is much better, as in four groups of five, followed by Super 8 semifinals and finals.
Yeah, exactly. And you look at the current Football World Cup, they have that same format. You know, each group has only four teams and two teams progress further.
Yeah, it just makes all the games highly consequential. And, you know, the big teams can't afford to just sit back and take it easy. And oftentimes what happens with like the big groups in cricket, like the big teams know that even if they slip up once, they can easily come back because the formats are so forgiving. And I understand that cricket doesn't have the same luxury as football does. We don't have that many competitive nations, but it should strike a balance in between. And I think the T20 World Cup in 2024 does that. So pretty excited.
Yeah. No, the reason cricket doesn't have that many competitive nations is our own fault. We have never encouraged and fostered these things. I mean, if you look at the history of cricket, there's a very strong examples time and time again where any promising nation was just completely cut out of the, you know, cricketing fraternity as such.
Because it wasn't a Commonwealth nation. So
yeah. Either that or England just perceived them as a threat or something. I don't know. But yeah, it was just that.
Best example of that is Argentina. And yeah, I won't say much, not to prolong the podcast. But yeah, Argentina, I think Jared Kimber's also done an episode on them. And
yeah, he has.
A great book called Evita Burndowner Pavilion. It's written by a couple of journalists from England.
Oh, nice.
Who do reporting for The Cricketer, I think. And I recommend reading that book, because I purchased it on Amazon. And it's a great read. It's all about the history of South American cricket. And apparently Argentina versus Uruguay is the second oldest rivalry in cricket after US and Canada. And they used to play quite regularly in the late 1800s, early 1900s. But yeah, unfortunately, all that's gone away now. So Uruguay are not even a member. And
which is sad, really, isn't it?
It is sad. And then football is king. So I don't look at South America as a big growth region for cricket. But Brazil, on the other hand, especially on the female side, they are doing a lot of good things. So fingers crossed that something happens.
Yeah, they might come back up again. You never know. You know, I find it very, not interesting, but I find it very encouraging that there are certain countries where women's cricket is the main driving force, like Brazil and in Thailand and Uganda. Yeah, Tanzania as well. Yeah, which is good, isn't it? And I think once the women's team tastes that success, then, you know, perhaps the men's side could look at that and go, hey, you know, our women are like really good at this. I wonder if we should give it a try.
Yeah, and I think the ICC should also increase the amount of teams in the Women's World Cups, which still remains quite limited. at 8 in the ODI World Cup and 10 in T20. And I know that's getting increased to 10 and 12, but yeah, that's pathetic. Like, at least in the T20 format, they should go to 16, because I reckon some of the games will be one-sided, yes, but you have to strike a balance between development and exclusivity.
I mean, if you look at it this way, Thailand recently beat the Pakistani women's team, and you know, even though that technically constitutes an upset, I wouldn't call it an upset at all. A, because you know, the Thai women's team has been getting better year after year, and B, it's Pakistan. Sorry, but you know, it's just a thing with Pakistan. I don't know what it is, but it is.
Hey, that's right, where they're good to watch for entertainment.
Yeah, true. So the name of the book, just for the listener's sake, is Evita Burned Down Our Pavilion.
Yeah, Evita Burned Down Our Pavilion. I'll give you the full name. Let me just look that up.
Yeah, no, I just checked it. So it's Evita Burned Down Our Pavilion, A Cricket Odyssey Through Latin America, something. And the authors are James Coyne and Timothy Abraham.
Correct.
Oh, okay, excellent. Now, moving on. Sandeep, your turn.
Well, I think we have to mention this. I mean, the reason three of us Indians are having at this time of the day in different parts of the world is because of this. I mean, India winning the 1983 World Cup. I mean, how did that happen? I mean, it's beyond belief, really. I mean, India was nothing in 1983 in ODI cricket, right? They were just the laughing stock of ODI cricket at the time. West Indies was the most professional unit ever at the time. Australia had a good tri series that had started about 1978-79. So they were having yearly tri series going on. They had invited India once in 1980, and India were smashed. West Indies was doing well in those tri-series matches. England was a good team as well, and they were playing at home. Pakistan and New Zealand were better than us, way better than us in ODI. Our level was about Sri Lanka and Zimbabwe's level at that time. And we went on to win. I mean, there was nothing World Cup to say that India had any chance whatsoever. I mean, you can watch any number of Bollywood movies to convince yourself that India had a chance. The motivation speeches of Kapil Dev and all that rubbish, but I don't think Kapil Dev was that great a captain either, to be honest. But I mean, it just beggars belief. I mean, there is even winning one match was considered to be a great result for India, but they not only won one match. I mean, they beat West Indies in the group stage as well. Then they beat Australia in the group stage and somehow qualify for the semi-final. And you would imagine that that's as good as it gets, but then they beat England in the semi-final. England had a very easy run into the semi-final on the other side, beating everybody. So they were fancy to win. And the final against West Indies, I mean, how do you defend 183 in 60 overs against a batting lineup that consists of Greedy Chains, Richards, Lloyd, and all those people? There are no words to explain how this came about, really. But the consequences of that win are there for us to see. I mean, India became a big superpower of cricket, and probably cricket has gone on to become big because of that win.
Definitely. I mean, if it wasn't for that win, I don't think, you know, cricket would be as big in India as it is now. It perhaps may have eventually happened, but I think what's equally important with that win is India winning the World Championship of Cricket in 85 and Jagmohan Dalmia being the treasurer or secretary of BCCI at that time.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the 83 final is a big upset, and I agree. Like, under normal circumstances, you would, because it's India who had
not won a single game in the previous editions of the World Cup except for their match against East Africa.
Yeah.
They were beaten by Sri Lanka in one of the World Cups. I think it was 79 that Sri Lanka beat them.
Yes.
And then suddenly they come to this World Cup. They beat West Indies in the first league game that they played.
Yeah.
Then got absolutely hammered by West Indies in the second league game. And then they scored 183 in a final, which is an absolute subpar score, given that West Indies in the previous two finals had built massive scores against England and Australia.
Yeah.
But before this World Cup, wouldn't you say India beating West Indies in West Indies during that tour before the World Cup, they had that one victory in Burbese in Guyana?
Yes.
Yeah. So wouldn't you say that would have been the match that would have been the better upset?
True. I mean, but...
I think it's being the World Cup, it adds an extra dimension to the pressure. And everybody, you know, all the cricket nations around the globe are watching. So that win to me, like, has higher significance. So I'll just add my two cents. So I've never watched the game live. I've watched the highlights, of course, because it was before I was born. But growing up in India, it's all I heard people talking about. So my mom and my parents, who are big fans of cricket, and like the whole friend circle, their dads, their moms, you know, it was a big, huge topic of conversation with them every time the World Cup came around.
Yeah, it was huge. Just, I mean, nobody. Because nobody.
India didn't win until 2011, and they still haven't won. They've still had just the two World Cups, and that's it.
No. Yeah, but that's partly because of dodgy selection and strategies and, changing tactics midway through the tournament and things like that. So it's not like India doesn't have the bench strength or the talent to do so.
Of course.
But, it's a lot of other factors.
Yeah.
83 win was just massive, absolutely massive.
Yeah. I mean, but even the Brabis win at the first league match, I mean, India had put up a decent score for themselves to defend, at least. Not in the final. I mean, 183 in 60 overs is nothing score. You would fancy
I mean, if you look at the current scoring rate that India has, especially with KL Rahul and Shikhar Dhawan and all of those guys, I'm sure they could put up a similar total in 50 overs too.
Yeah. But 183 in 60 overs, I mean, that West Indies side would have achieved any other day. I mean,
you could wake up Viv Richards from sleep in the middle of the night and tell him, this is what we got to go. And he'd go, yeah, man, got it. Don't worry about it, man.
Yeah. Hey, one special moment that my mom keeps talking about, so I should mention it from that game, is Kapil Dev's catch.
Yes.
Phenomenal. And we spoke about this recently, remember, about role of Van der Merwe's catch against South Africa? Like,
it had those
connotations, like running backwards, big skier, diving, getting it. Of course, Kapil Dev didn't dive, but it was an astounding catch that changed the whole context of the game.
Correct.
And I think equally important, not just the catch, but Balwinder Sandhu's ball to Greenidge, the one that he shouldered arms and got bowled.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Big, big in-swinger first up.
It was as if Greenidge didn't even expect that to happen. So.
Yeah, exactly. And to think that Greenidge played a lot of his cricket in England as well.
Yes.
So, it was just like somehow the stars had aligned and then, conspired to produce this result.
Yeah.
Correct.
That was one. Okay. The repercussions from that is... present everywhere around us, India's success in subsequent tournaments, the emergence of cricket as a major cultural phenomenon in India, not just sport, but the fan following that followed it, whether it was Gavaskar, Kapil Dev, Shastri, Azhar, Tendulkar, Jadeja, and Dhoni and Kohli and everybody who's living through it right now. The IPL after the 2007 win, the big money that has come in, these guys are now superstars. Yeah, it's just...
That was the start of all that. So that's why, I'm glad you mentioned it, Sandeep. It's highly significant.
It is.
And there's a movie about it too, if you want to watch.
I did watch it. I wouldn't recommend paying money to watch it in the cinema. But, if you're doing nothing on a Sunday afternoon and it's on TV... I think it is on TV. It's on Netflix, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it is.
It's
decent enough, but there are certain sections, I mean, where I think the film struggles with discussing things like, are we a serious film about a major sporting achievement, or are we going to go down the comedy route and just parody everyone?
Yeah.
I mean, they have Mohinder Amarnath in the film, but, you know, he plays his father's role. He plays Lala Amarnath in the film, which I thought was just weird.
And a lot of hyperbole as well. I mean, there was.
Deepika Padukone as Romy, and, you know, her then walking out of the ground and trying to get back in because she was, this is just bullshit. Like, why bloat up a film, you know, when you can just stick to the actual premise of it?
Yeah,
just watch the highlights there. Don't watch the movie.
Yeah, just watch the highlights. Yeah, watch the highlights of the 83 World Cup done. And now, what have you got next, Shaunak? Because I don't think, in terms of sheer significance, we can beat this 83 World Cup one.
No, so I've got an interesting one. So this will be my last one. So it's Bangladesh versus Australia in the 2005 NatWest Tri Series. Mm-hmm. So at that time, Bangladesh, you know, they were a newly minted full member nation. They had been a test nation for 5 years by 2005, but their record was horrendous. So out of 35 tests, they had only won one, and that 20 of those defeats of the rest of the 34, like, it came by an innings. And in ODIs, their record was terrible. Out of the 107 games they had played till then, they had only won 9 games. And so that's why it's incredible. Because if you remember, in 2005, that Australian team was amazing. They were in the middle of their winning all the World Cups in succession. So 99, they had won. 2003, they had won. 2007, they won again. Had like McGrath, Warne, all the big names that you can remember, like Ponting, And so what happened on that day is Australia made 249 for 5 after a shaky start. But incredibly, Mohammad Ashraful of Bangladesh, he played an unbelievable knock. He hit a runner ball century to guide Bangladesh to probably, which I will term as one of the biggest ever upsets in ODI cricket, considering like where Bangladesh was at that time. And apparently, you know, that game, more than anything, like, really popularized cricket in Bangladesh. It was already popular, but people were kind of resigned to, like, you know, defeats upon defeats. So I read match reports where, like, people were dancing on the streets in Dhaka. And there was a real sense that the Bangladesh cricket team, which had been associate member for so long and only had just become a full member 5 years ago, they had finally arrived in the world of full member cricket.
That has been the explanation for the last 17 years as well. Every time Bangladesh wins something, we go, oh, Bangladesh has finally arrived, and only for them to disappoint. Like, you know, case in point, this win against New Zealand this year and then the loss. Then they go to South Africa. And, you know, thankfully, they beat South Africa in a one-day series, but then in the test, they just disappoint.
Yeah, although I think Bangladesh nowadays, they have become a cricketing furniture, as in, like, everyone knows them, like, everyone knows they're a full member. They play in Asia Cups. Back then, like, in 2005, they were still a new member, and a lot of cricket-playing nations didn't know much about them. So I think in that context, it was a huge result in 2005. And nowadays, you know, Bangladesh, like, they're just up and down and generally mostly poor. But that's more to do with how they're playing rather than, like, how well-known they are, you know. So
I think now Bangladesh has reached that stage when somebody beats them, that now becomes an upset. Isn't it? Like, you know, this is how long they have been in the cricketing fraternity. I mean, their win against Pakistan in the 99 World Cup, you know, that is what catapulted them towards full member status and got them the test status and everything. But their performances were never keeping in line with expectations until this 2005 win against Australia. And then we really thought, oh, this is finally happening. Bangladesh finally have unearthed a batsman, you know, who can actually play at the international stage. But then Ashraful's star just waxed and waned, well, mostly waned. And then he had one other innings of significance. But thankfully, he got, I won't say replaced, but overshadowed by Tamim Iqbal, who came in. And he was a much more consistent player at the top of the order for Bangladesh. And I think was
it's quite sad, like, how his potential remained unfulfilled. But yeah, I mean, since then, Bangladesh have had many world-class cricketers, and I would include Shakib Al Hasan as, like, one of the best all-rounders in cricket in modern times anyway, period.
Especially in the white ball format, yeah.
Yeah, especially in the white ball format, not so much in tests. And yeah, they've had Mushfiqur Rahim, who's a good player, and Mahmudullah. And yeah, their team's improved a lot. I think the problem with Bangladesh is consistency and not winning the key moments. So, like, I mean, even in the recent T20 World Cup, they gave India a very, like, big scare, which no one was expecting, like Litton Das to just come out and play that blistering innings.
Yeah, but that is how, you know, T20 should have been played, isn't it? I think it was India who was more complacent. And if it wasn't for that freak run out of Litton Das, they might have won that game.
Oh, absolutely. I believe that. I think if Litton Das had just survived for another 5-6 overs, I think India would have definitely lost that game.
We would have seen a new format in the next T20 World Cup where India is, like, given a bye directly to the semifinal. Everybody else has to sort of go through the qualifiers in the main draw, and India sitting there occupying one slot in the semifinal. That's it.
No, even better than that, Sagar. It would have been that, oh, they play in the league stage, but even if they get eliminated, it doesn't count. And because you still want India playing those games, right? You still want the billion people watching India.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just funny.
Going back to the 2005 win by Bangladesh, I mean, how much do you think it affected Australia in the Ashes? I mean, do you think it had any impact?
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never thought about it that way. Because, you know, when you look at Australia's loss in 2005 Ashes, you think of Glenn McGrath stepping on that ball and cracking his ankle. But, yeah, it is a good point. Honestly, I don't think that loss made any difference to Australia, to be honest. Right?
Probably not, yeah.
But they were very embarrassed. I remember, like, reading an interview, I think with Glenn McGrath it was, and he's like, oh, I don't want to see the front pages of Australian newspapers tomorrow.
But, you know, in terms of sheer legacy, what you mentioned earlier, Shaunak, especially with Kenya, where the mainstream population never warmed up to the sport, I think this did the exact opposite for cricket in Bangladesh. And it's not just Bangladesh, but when you look at the fan following in Nepal, Bangladesh, Afghanistan, you see what it means to those people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't really matter which tournament they're playing, or is it a bilateral series, who the opponents are, but each win means so much to them.
Yeah, and they come out in big numbers, even though, like, the team may be playing badly. I've just got so much love for Bangladesh's fan base. You know, they come with their little tigers, those little toy tigers. And
Yeah.
Very, very passionate fans.
You know, that's good merchandise idea over there.
Yeah, definitely is.
So my next one is Netherlands against England.
Oh, yes. Go for it.
Which one? Yeah, because there were two. The first one, I think, was even more memorable because, again, I was watching that live on TV, obviously. And it was in England. 2009, I had just moved up to Manchester, so I wasn't able to go to Lord's. But, you know, this is a game at Lord's, cricket's showcase tournament in the T20 sphere, a format that England had invented or came up with. Stuart Broad's bowling this last over. Netherlands have somehow managed to hang in there. Now, you know, in this day and age, like, say, let's say 2022, 160 in 20 overs is kind of considered par on a decent wicket.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is like after T20 tactics and strategies and attacking batting have evolved. Back in 2009, 160 in 20 overs was a high score.
Oh, yes, it was. Way above par.
Yeah. And even then, England was ahead of most other teams where they had a separate squad for the T20s. You had people like Ravi Bopara and Luke Wright playing in that game. And, you know, Luke Wright was a fantastic T20 player. And these guys scored 160. Netherlands was something like 25 for two within the power play itself. And you kind of think, well, this is not going to end well. And somehow they just hang on. I think Schifferle was at the end, but it was
Tom or Tim de Groot, who was the main guy in the middle of the chase, probably scored like 45, 50 odd. It comes to this last over. Netherlands need two runs of the last ball. Stuart Broad has bowled decent enough. All he needs to do is bowl a dot ball or maybe just give one run. The batsman, you know, he just hits it back. Broad fields. The ball is in his hand. Netherlands have no option but to run because, you know, if they don't run, they lose. If they attempt a run, they might elicit a mistake from Broad. And Broad throws it at the stumps. Like, he's basically there midway at that pitch. And, you know, probably 9 times out of 10, he would have hit the stumps. That particular day was the 10th time he missed the stumps. Not only did he miss the stumps, but that ball goes for an overthrow and Netherlands run across. Then you have, like, this montage of Broad with his hands on his face, like utterly embarrassed and in disbelief at what had happened. And you have the two Netherlands batsmen in the background just jumping for joy. And that was, it just made my day.
Yeah,
I still remember Stuart Broad's face there at the end.
Oh, it was a sight to behold.
Yeah, it was a sight to behold.
More so than what Yuvraj did to him in 2007.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I almost felt sorry for Broad. Like, you know, I was really happy that Netherlands won, of course. But, like, yeah, how sad Broad looked. I almost felt sorry for him.
Well, I think the only person that you would want to feel sorry for after that was Ben Stokes when Brathwaite hit him for those 4 sixes. He was just distraught and on the field, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, I have no sympathy for either of them, but still.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was like Netherlands' big win. And then they followed that up with another win in 2014, this time defending only 130-odd. And they had England all out for 88. And this is England that had Alex Hales, Owen Morgan, Moeen Ali, Josh Butler, Jordan, Broad, and Bopara.
A proper shellacking that was.
Absolutely. Like 50 runs was the big margin of victory. Mm-hmm. 50 runs. So those were mine, like the ones that I remember a lot. Now, not surprisingly, they were basically associate versus full nation teams. But there's just something special about, you know, the unfancied underdog taking it to the big boys and then beating them at their own game.
Absolutely. And then Netherlands, they have professionalized a lot now. I think it's still not where it should be. So only a handful of cricketers have professional contracts and it doesn't pay, like, you know, as much as even, say, Zimbabwe. But anyway, I think back in 2009, they were all semi-professional. So apart from the county players, they were all amateurs, basically. And one interesting fact that I wanted to mention from the same game is Dirk Nannes was a Dutch bowler in that game. Mm. And he went on to represent Australia in another T20 World Cup. And I think he remains one of the very few people to have represented two nations in T20 World Cups alongside Roelof van der Merwe.
True. But, you look at where Netherlands is now. So if you're talking about the legacy of those wins, a lot of Netherlands players now also play in the county leagues. Mm-hmm. And Netherlands as a country has improved significantly. You know, they had I can't understand why they haven't had a T20 international against England when they did have like a 3-match 1-day series just before this recent World Cup.
I think that too was because of the Super League. I think if it wasn't due to the Super League, I don't think England would have gone over and played one day games over there. So it's quite sad that the Super League, which forced the big nations to play games against the smaller nations, unfortunately, the ICC is no longer persisting with that. And there are discussions that I think what constitutes currently as League 2 in world cricket, where Scotland, Namibia, USA, PNG, Oman and UAE play. Netherlands might drop down to that level and have a league there. But yeah, it's quite sad that I don't think they will ever get the summer of cricket that they've had this year, where they had England, Pakistan, and West Indies visiting them to play cricket.
I mean, it's not that far from England. So, you know, visiting teams could easily do a stopover either in Netherlands, Scotland, Ireland before they head off to England. And they can do that in turns as well. So that way, each of these countries gets the matches that they need to benefit. You know, it brings much needed revenue, recognition. But for me, it's all about respect, isn't it? I mean, England not playing Netherlands just because they don't have to, or only playing them because of the commitments of the Super League. That is sad. That just shows how arrogant you are. I mean, would it hurt to send, even if it was a second string England side, but under the guise of England rather than England Lions, next doors, and say, look, you guys have a, you know, bilateral, maybe 3 1-days, 3 T20s, and see how we go. It's good for the development of the English youngsters as well. And it gives the Dutch players a good solid chance at having a go at a full member country. And likewise, you know, with Australia sending someone similar to PNG and Vanuatu, for example, or India sending a similar squad to Nepal, or inviting Afghanistan over. You know, there's so many things that can be done. But
yeah, can't agree more. And, you know, the Dutch pace bowler, Paul van Meekeren, he's made some interesting suggestions. So Netherlands apparently used to play in the domestic England one-day competition, which have, I think, used to be 40 overs back in the day. And they, I think, only played a couple of seasons. But, yeah, I think there are talks that Scotland want to get back into that. And then Netherlands potentially would be interested. But now whether that happens, whether the English Cricket Board, they have the capacity or the interest in doing that, that I don't know. But also what Van Meekeren is suggesting is what you just said, Sagar, that teams, instead of warming up, playing against, you know, below strength, under strength county teams before the Test match series or one day series against England, why not like come and play one day in Netherlands? I think that would be much better preparation for the touring teams rather than playing some like third string county side.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this thing could be incorporated as part of the FTP agreement that, say, for example, if India is going to England, they could either stop at Netherlands and play a series over there on their way to England, or they could meet Netherlands in England and do something over there, you know, as part of the preparation so that they get acclimatized to the conditions a bit better. Now, going back to that earlier point about Netherlands and county cricket, that had to stop, I think, after Netherlands got full ODI status.
Mm-hmm.
What annoyed me more was, I mean, when the Netherlands played West Indies in the ODI series last year, I mean, there are Netherlands players in the county who are not released to play for those matches, so...
not just a couple. I think there were about 4 or 5 players.
4 or 5, yeah. So that was very annoying.
That's basically the ECB being tricks.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no other word for it. And
yeah, exactly, isn't it? I mean, like, I'm sure that the counties, I don't know what the exact regulations are, but when it comes to releasing players for national duty, you know, the county should not be stepping in and saying, no, you can't go.
Yeah.
But then that brings us back to a point that you were mentioning earlier, Sagar, with cricket probably needing to go in the way of football in the future, where like you have international windows and then clubs have no excuse for not releasing the players.
Yeah, see, that will eventually happen once the IPL franchise owners own all the franchises in global cricket, because then, you know, unlike, you know, your English Premier League, which goes on for, say, 8 months of the year, you know, the cricket leagues are usually a month and a half, 2 months tops. And then what will happen is that player will go from Mumbai Indians to Durban Indians to Kingston Indians to wherever they want to rotate. And then you have this 2 month window where everybody plays bilateral international games or the World Cup. Because, you know, the ICC needs a few events themselves, right?
Yeah. I don't want to go to that world. Hopefully we don't, you know, because it's a pretty dystopian situation if that happens. Hopefully, like, you know, cricket's in a better place than that. But yeah, as you were mentioning, so I wouldn't be surprised if that.
Yeah. See, and this is
30 years.
Correct. This is another difference between cricket and other sports. We are hopeless romantics. We love staying with the old ways and cherishing the sound of leather on willow and that, you know, high upper elbow and the white picket fences and the umpires in white coats and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why we like it when the underdog beats the established team, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. any notable mentions? I've got a few. So I've got Zimbabwe beating England in 92. I've got Zimbabwe beating Australia in 83 World Cup.
Yeah, so it's not strictly... one notable mention that I had, and it's not a historical result, so I don't know whether it qualifies for this chat. However, I'll still mention it. So USA beating Ireland in a T20.
Oh, yeah. That was... Yeah. Was it this year or last year?
It was very recent. I think it may have been earlier this year or late last year. But it was an incredible result, as in it constitutes the USA's first win over a full member in any format. Mm. And okay, it's Ireland who are also new to the world, but it still doesn't matter. I mean, the disparity in like player resources between USA and Ireland is still big. Although I think now that may be changing with all the exciting developments happening there. So it remains to be seen. We had a conversation earlier in the podcast about what a gold mine the US cricket community could be. And it doesn't have to even like rival NFL. It never will, but it doesn't even have to come close to that. I think even if cricket manages to capture even 1/3 of their audience, I think it would put cricket in a great place in the USA.
No, that's true. Now, speaking of Ireland, they have been a mixed bag. So, you know, like they beat Pakistan in 2007, they beat England in the 2011 World Cup and in the T20 World Cup this year. They also beat England in 2020, chasing a similar score as the 2011 one. So I think they chased down 328, 330 in Southampton.
Yep.
But then they have lost to Zimbabwe. They lost to West Indies in West Indies recently. They lost to Hong Kong. They have lost to Scotland, USA, Emirates, Oman. Now, when you look at what Afghanistan has achieved, and Afghanistan and Ireland were two parallel success stories in cricket at one stage, Afghanistan has lost far fewer matches against lower-ranked teams than what Ireland has.
Yeah, I think there's a difference also in between the playing numbers, because in Afghanistan, cricket is a religion. Afghanistan is a much higher population than Ireland does. And
yeah, but don't call it a religion. The Taliban might take offense.
Correct. And, you know, while we celebrate Ireland's successes, it's still a minority sport over there. So, and, you know, cricket is still growing in popularity in Ireland. So there's some good news there. But with Ireland, like ODIs have always been their stronger format, and they have been very poor, actually, in T20s. And this T20 World Cup that just took place a couple of months ago, I think that was the best, actually, I've seen Ireland play in T20 format.
To agree. And I think it's partly because, again, opportunities, talent development, these things take time. But they've got, I mean, I follow their official Twitter handle on Twitter, of course. And it looks like the Irish women's team's also slowly but steadily improving. And they've got a good first-class structure in place. They've got a good domestic tournament in place as well. And so they focus mostly on building the team from the ground up rather than focusing on the senior men's side first, because they knew that they had to avoid the same mistakes that Kenya and Nepal did. And another country that's following in similar footsteps is Japan. So they're building that grassroots cricket first.
Correct.
And then sort of focusing on the national side.
Yeah, one interesting fact that I wanted to mention about Ireland, Sagar, while we're discussing the topic, is they finally got approval to build a stadium in Abbottstown. So I think they have cricket grounds already. But what generally happens is they are basically club-level cricket grounds, which need to be temporarily upgraded when big visiting teams come over. So they need to put, I think, temporary floodlights, temporary seating in place. Now, what this plan ensures that they will get a permanent stadium. I think it's on the outskirts of Dublin.
Wow,
I don't know how long
nice.
It will take to build, but they want to have it ready before the 2030 World Cup, which they're supposed to co-host with Scotland and England.
Well, depending on capacity, isn't it? If you're looking at a 20,000-25,000 seat capacity, which is huge, you know, by any Irish standards. Mm-hmm. You're probably looking at 4 to 5 years.
Yeah. And that would make hosting cricket in Ireland a lot cheaper, because they wouldn't have to worry about all the putting up temporary accommodation and everything. Temporary seating. So that's exciting news. And yeah, I want to see, you know, where it heads in the future. And I'm optimistic about their future.
Me too. Me too. And it's good to see so many other countries coming up. And I suppose in other notable mentions, Kuwait beating Emirates this year would have been classified as an upset. Finland beating Denmark probably too. Like, and of course, now this is basically amongst the fringe cricket-playing nations. But yeah, but Kuwait beating Emirates, I think that's a big upset, even within the Gulf region.
Absolutely. Yeah,
because you know, after Emirates, probably Oman would be your default second most strong team, I think.
Yeah, watch out for Bahrain as well. So they almost eliminated UAE from the global qualifier, and if it wasn't for Vritti Aravind's innings, actually they would have been eliminated even before they reached the T20 World Cup finals. So yeah, Bahrain have some good talent coming up, although the cricket scene is quite mysterious. So we don't have much info about what's happening over there. But the way they performed in the sub-regionals, in the global qualifiers recently, that was pretty great. And Oman as well, as you mentioned, like they're doing some good things, but they have a very aging team. So it remains to be seen how they replace their aging players with younger talent.
A lot of it depends on incentives, because I think the last time, what's that guy's name? The chap who's in charge of Omani cricket, the big patron father figure there. He was mentioning that most of those players are still like an amateur base rather than professional. So they might need to look at professional contracts to get people involved in it and to get the game. I mean, from what I've seen of the stadium over there, which incidentally is called Al Imarat Stadium and confuses the hell out of me because I always think it's in the Emirates, and it looks a really good ground. I mean, they don't have a lot of seats, but you know, it's fairly level ground. You've got these mountains as your backdrop, and you know, it would be a good place to play.
The way I see it is the desert version of Queensland. It's got the beautiful mountains in the background, small boutique ground as you mentioned. But yeah, it's just in the desert rather than in the cold alpine southern South Island of New Zealand.
Yeah, so you mean Queenstown, not Queensland.
Queenstown, sorry. Yeah, not Queensland.
A lot of Australians are going to be upset about this now.
Yeah. So Queenstown, yeah, with the view of the beautiful view of the remarkable mountain range.
Sandeep, any notable mentions you'd like to mention?
Yes, I think the 1983 Zimbabwe beating Australia, that was a big upset. And then 1989 Sri Lanka beating West Indies in the Nehru Cup, that was a big upset at that time. That was the first time Sri Lanka ever beat West Indies in an ODI match.
Yeah, true.
And then I was half a mind really with about this with Sri Lanka winning the 1996 World Cup. I know they were a good team, but did people expect them to go all the way? I'm not sure. So,
just as we talked about that 1983 win for India, kickstarting cricketing development and fandom in India. I think the 1996 World Cup win by Sri Lanka, it displaced volleyball as the national game of Sri Lanka, and cricket became this craze.
Right, that's very interesting. Yeah. So I wouldn't say it was a major upset because Sri Lanka was doing well at the time. So, but winning it all, I don't think many people expected that.
And their approach to cricket, you know, it was before our time. The way they approached one-day cricket and they exploited the fielding restrictions, I think they were the first team that used that approach of pinch hitting.
And all their players, they had specific roles to play and they played it to perfection. So I think that was very good teamwork by them at that time. So yeah, so that was the other one that I was wanting to mention.
Because given Australia's performance against West Indies in the semifinals and then the manner in which they beat India in the league phases, I had sort of hoped that, not hoped, but I had taken it for granted that Australia had the upper hand. But then I think Sri Lanka had a far bigger point to prove against the Australians having, come back from Australia and Muralidharan's chucking saga and the way they were treated over there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the general perception. So
yeah, The other thing was in that final, if you remember, that was the first final that the chasing team won.
And yeah. But
Ratunda won that loss and put Australia into bad. People were saying, what the hell are you doing? Because yeah. you don't. but Ratunda knew what their strength was. Its strength was chasing that target. So
absolutely. Because then they knew how well Kaluvitharna and Jayasurya had to bat to. Yeah. You know, like chip off that target within the first 10, 15 overs.
Yeah.
And De Silva was just in sublime form that whole tournament.
Yeah, I think the middle order was very consistent as well. So if Jayasurya Karitrana had an off day, then the middle order would pick the pieces.
Yeah, because you had Guru Singha, De Silva, Mahanama, Rantunga. All of them were playing really well that season.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it was notable how easy the chase was, considering they were Sri Lanka were tottering at 23 for 2, both Jayasurya yeah. and Kaluvitharna dismissed. But yeah, Guru Sinha and De Silva just steadied the ship, and then De Silva and Ranatunga finished it off. And in the end, it was such an easy win, 7 wickets, yeah. 4 overs yeah. to spare.
Yeah, definitely. I think this has been really good discussion about some of these games in the past and, you know, what it has led to after each respective win. I've enjoyed it. I'm hoping you guys have enjoyed it too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Sagar. I've really enjoyed the trip down memory lane and just reliving some of my early, you know, great experiences with cricketing nostalgia, cricketing memory, just reliving famous games.
Including your pre-birth memories as well.
Yes, that came from research and knowledge.
Yeah. But it just feels like there was a part of you over there, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. What I will say is that the Netherlands versus Australia win that I mentioned, the one that happened in 1964, I knew about it before today's podcast. So in my defense, I didn't just research it for this episode. Actually, I knew about it, although not very long, I think. 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, no, that's fine. And like I said, you know, that's like a pre-birth memory, isn't it? Because that happened even before you. No, yeah, but just, and thank you.
Commentary in Dutch, that really struck me. And I'll send you the link so you guys can both watch. Because,
yes.
Yeah, it's, I mean, cricket, you know, it's a colonial game. And all, even the non-traditional nations that you see playing, everyone generally like speaks English. They get interviewed in English, but to hear like Dutch commentary, I mean, that was something else.
I don't know about the commentary for the games in the Icelandic league, because, you know, they broadcast their games on YouTube. But the ones that take place in Japan, especially the recent Japanese international, they had dual commentary channels. So you had 2-3 guys doing the English commentary, and you had 2-3 people doing the commentary in Japanese as well, simultaneously. And you could tune in to listen to either of them.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah. And this is a point that Harsha Bhogle once made when he was chatting with Jared Kimber, that, you know, perhaps in the future we might get these things where you have 3 or 4 different commentary feeds for the same match, and the listener can tune into the one that they want to, you know, that they prefer. Because some people might prefer a little bit more analytical, stats heavy kind of feed. Some people might prefer the general banter that's there on Channel 9 nowadays that qualifies as commentary, but it isn't. And
it's atrocious. But yeah,
some people might prefer, you know, like guys like Chappell and Bhogle and Gavaskar talking about these things. We don't know. Because, you know, there's a market for everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was a time when I used to watch a cricket match on TV and I would listen to BBC Test Match Special online. So that way I got what I wanted. So, you know, going forward, we might get, I mean, I think Doordarshan does this as well. So you've got a Hindi commentary feed on one of the channels for Doordarshan or whoever's broadcasting in India. And then you get your standard English one on the other feed.
Yeah, correct. There's also Bengali ones. So there's people comment. So in West Bengal, if you turn on the radio these days, there's commentary in Bengali. And I think Crick Info has a Hindi version of the website as well.
Yes, they do. Yeah. Bhalo ache.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else anyone would like to discuss?
No, nothing from me, thanks. I've had a great time. So thanks again for the invite, and I've enjoyed myself.
So I wish you, you know, good tidings for Christmas, because it's only next week. I don't think I'll be able to do anything much between now and then, but I hope to catch up after Christmas, maybe to do like a rundown of what's happened in cricket this year. And you know, rather than talking about the major highlights, I think we might do like about the controversies in cricket this year, something like that.
Yeah, that would be very interesting. Thanks.
Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful to have you both. I'll post the details about the 13th Man YouTube video in the show notes, as well as the link to the book Evita Burned Down Our Pavilion.
Thank you.
It's good to know. So thanks for bringing that to our attention, Shaunak. Much appreciated.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, have a good day and whatever's remaining of the weekend.
Yep, you too. And enjoy the Football World Cup final tonight.
No, I'll be asleep. I've got to go to work tomorrow. You know, I'm not that much of a football fan that I'll stay up till 3 in the morning just to watch a game.
Fair enough. But yeah, enjoy the rest of your weekend, guys. And
you too.
Yeah, same to you.
Have a great Christmas and New Year. And yeah, we'll catch up again.
Okay, bye.
Thanks, guys. See ya.
Bye.
Bye.